Du hører på Litteraturhusets podcast som presenterer bearbeidede versjoner av samtaler og foredrag fra Litteraturhusets program. Du interessert I mer informasjon, kan du gå til litteraturhuset.no for oversikt over alle våre arrangementer.
Good evening, everyone, and a very warm welcome to all of you, and especially to tonight's guest of honor, Adania Shibley. My name is Susanna Kaluza, and I'm the director here at the House of Literature. How do you wrap your head around news reports of growing numbers of murdered children and parents, of bombings and atrocities? In the face of a horrendous reality, it is easy to become numb, to look away, to reduce growing body counts to ungraspable statistics. The nameless protagonist in Adania Shibley's award-winning novel, Minor Detail, chooses to focus on one minor detail, the capture and killing of a Bedouin girl by Israeli soldiers in 1949. Her search for traces of this story becomes a prism through which the reader can glimpse everyday life under Israeli occupation. However, the novel also explores how the past continues to inform the present, how fear and suppression manifests in the body, how language has the power to name and to erase, and so much more than the slight size of this brilliant book would suggest. Adania Shibley holds a PhD in media and cultural studies. She has published three novels and has already gained a position as a critically acclaimed novelist. Minor Detail is the first to be translated into Norwegian by Oda Vinsnes. To talk to Shibley on stage, we are so happy to have with us Martha Magister, herself an acclaimed author, and whose latest novel, The Shadow King, was translated into Norwegian last year. So please, without much further ado, give them both a warm welcome.
You know, we have the habit in Palestine, like, you first, and then we might hit each other, like, you first. We solved it amicably in this case.
Yeah, we have the same in Ethiopia, so this was not going to end well. This is so special for me. Adania is a wonderful friend of mine. She's also a brilliant writer, an incredibly exciting intellect. We try sometimes to talk very seriously, so we're going to do that today. But this is someone that I have had such incredible moments of so much laughter that I can't even breathe sometimes. I don't know what will happen today. But Adania, it's really wonderful to talk to you. We're here to talk about Minor Detail that is published now here in Norway. And I'd like to start off with that, but as often the way that our conversations go, they range far and wide. And so all of you should be prepared for that. But what if we start with a reading of this book? And maybe you can set up a little bit of the scene, and then we'll move into the book and talk more about it.
Yeah, I never suggest to read, because I hate reading. I love reading, but not aloud, and especially not my text. As I say, it's already a torture to write them, and then to go back and to read them is another layer of torture. But there was an unfortunate or a weird incident that happened last week. I was in Germany. And I noticed we were walking. It was late at night. We were walking, a group of people I didn't know well, but among them writers. I don't want to say the context exactly, just to keep it private. And I saw, this is Germany, dark, depressing, so on. And suddenly I see some writing in Arabic. And, like, you know, I'm I'm in love with the Arabic language, as I will discuss, but then my heart really opens suddenly that I see these letters. So I read them, and I just kind of naively, like a kid who says, oh, look, I saw that. So I say, oh, look, there's this writing in Arabic. And one of the people asked me, oh, what is it? What is written there? Is it something about killing Jews? And at that moment, I really understood how Arabic is being treated, and how it's this whole kind of history, literary history, and literary linguistic sensitivity and attachment and love to a language is suddenly erased. This whole context is erased. And the sentence was beautiful, and it was actually also a sad sentence. Probably a drunken guy wrote it at the end of the night, saying that if you are suffering any troubles, you're just one element in history.
Wow.
And so you see, it's even his own writing of that becomes a subject of our violence that we project. So I suddenly had a different relation to Arabic, because it's also perhaps I was too much attached to writing the language and writing in the language and struggling with the language. But I realized this, how it has been reduced to something that is so violent. And therefore, I thought, okay, no, maybe sometimes we can smuggle a little bit of Arabic in your daily diet. So therefore, I will read now. I will read from the second chapter, just a paragraph. وبينما لم يتحرك صف السيارات سوى بضعة أمتار كنت قد انتهيت من دراسة جميع الشعارات والرسومات المخطوطة فوق الجدار الذي لم تبقى عليه تقريبا رقعة غير ملونة إضافة إلى صد كم هائل من الأولاد الذين حاولوا بيع أشياء لا حاجة لي بها بالمرة آخرهم كانت فتاة صغيرة شعرها منكوش ووجهها أسمر يسيل المخاط من أنفها تبيع العلكة فتحت حقيبتي وتناولت من داخلها منديلا ورقيا وقدمته إليها طالبة منها أن تنظف أنفها فاختطفته هي من يدي على الفور واختفت عن الأنظار ثم وقبل أن تلوح أمام الخوف فرصة الاستفراد بي ظهر بعض الأولاد ثانية محاولين بيع مناديل ورقية هذه المرة Thank you. You can guess which part.
So I want to talk a bit about the minor detail, but I want to backtrack because you've just spoken about Arabic and the beauty of the language, the history of it, the many layers that I don't speak Arabic, but everyone that I know that speaks it talks always about the beauty of it and the complexity of it. One of the first times I was at your apartment in Berlin, and we were getting ready to have dinner, Adania was in the midst of working on a new project. And I think we were talking about the difficulties of writing. And you were almost at a point where you felt you had reached a real marker of it. And you said, you know, you don't speak Arabic, so I can show you a little bit about what I'm doing. And you brought out your notebook, and you keep a notebook by your bed. You write by hand in this notebook, that's just a simple, plain notebook. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe you write in pencil. I might be wrong. But what I remember of that is how worn these pages were from writing, flipping over, writing, flipping over, writing, and maybe rewriting over it. And the care that I saw in that notebook. And there was a tenderness in there. And I don't know how to describe it, but I remember thinking when I saw that notebook, I said, you know, this is... There is a compassion and love in this process of writing that comes out through this notebook. I'll never forget that. So to have you read now in Arabic, I think is really wonderful. But I want to just talk about that process that you have of writing by hand in a notebook when so many writers would choose to do something like this on a computer. But it's the first thing you have when you wake up. Could you talk about that process of writing? And it feels like that first introduction to your day is Arabic and its language.
Yeah, you should never let a writer in your house.
This is what we do, especially after a few glasses of wine.
Yeah. I mean, even the relation, writing in Arabic, I perhaps had taught me how to live and how to love. But not to love in a sense that is love that is directed to an object or to a person, but to love and a point. Because it is a very difficult process. It's, as you described for me, really it is when I open my eyes. I actually write in bed. So basically, I open my eyes and I'm already in my office. You know, there's no distance between that and there's... And this transition is very important because it's almost my passage into the day and into life. I always, perhaps, when struggling with writing or struggling with language, and also finding these transformative moments, they already teach me how to proceed. I don't know how this happened. Because, you know, you describe me perhaps as a writer, but I always insist that I'm writing in the act, in the form of the verb, and not the noun. Because still, I trust this is a process that is important for all of us. Mm-hmm. Language, it is so much immediately there, engulfing us the moment also we realize ourselves. But perhaps for me, this realization requires this the demand in writing and the slowness in writing. I always feel the delay, and perhaps this delay is important, this gap that opens between me and the world, or between any of us and the world. I wonder sometimes how we deal with this gap, or how we enter the world from this gap and from our inabilities. Mm-hmm. I never considered myself as a kid capable of speaking well. I think I didn't speak well because I was really in love watching people how they speak. There was this fascination, immediate fascination, with how others speak, how others narrate, specifically because my parents didn't speak much. So for me, the act of speaking or telling a story was so precious. Really, like I grew up in a home that we didn't speak much. And of course, I realized later, why is this silence? And then you grow into this silence. Then fascinated by the moment that this silence is broken. Mm. But also because of the silence, you are not the good speaker. You end up not like the one who speaks so fluently. And this fluency perhaps is what writing embraces. Mm-hmm. So if like these failures, these silences, this disfluency is embraced by writing, is allowed, as actually writing also encourages. So in the morning when I wake up into this silence, I wake up into this disfluency, which I think is haunting me all of my life and even these days more than any other time. And it's almost like learning how to live again through writing. Mm. And then you discover you can make books and you can live from it, actually. So, yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, we mentioned how the history of Arabic language, you have texts from 1,500 years ago, poems by amazing poets. And an important moment for any poem to start for these poets was destruction, or a landscape that has no life. Mm-hmm. As kids, of course, we were always joking about this. Yes, like you see some ruined house, yeah, start a poem, man, go ahead. But it's very interesting that now I understand it, how language step in this moment of absence, of mm-hmm. gap, of destruction, and allows you to transform this moment into something else. And I think this is also where the moment we are allowed to leave reality and to think of different possibilities of reality. Maybe reality is too cruel, but we cannot allow that this option alone to be of cruelty. And I think this is where poetry comes in. And these poets really, like Umar al-Qais and Antar bin Shaddad, they truly believed or trusted in this transformation of opening into a new world away from the pain or from the destruction.
It's interesting that you call that you talk about the way that language can step into this silence or step into this gap, and the way that poetry often begins at a sense of witnessing of destruction. I'm thinking now of Minor Detail and the way there are two sections in this book. One is from the perspective of an Israeli commander, and the second section is decades later of a young woman who's trying to make sense of a killing that we can talk more about in detail about that. But the language in this book, and I wonder if you could talk about, describe it, because what strikes me, and I think what will strike most readers, it's not a spare language. But I have talked to you enough about the process of writing to know that you're very aware and very deliberate in what you choose to take away from a scene. You know, you'll write a scene and then take away and take away and take away and see what's left. And so in that, I imagine you working with silence as much as you are with language. And I wondered if you could talk about the ways that you do that in Minor Detail. The commander, the writing is so... the writing is internal to him. It is such a close perspective that what we get is the world through his eyes, but it's an intimate, intimate perspective and an intimate knowledge. I would love to hear about your process in thinking through this character and the choices that you made of inhabiting this person. And where other writers might have chosen to have grand, bombastic language that depicts all of the violences that we know occurred under Israeli occupation, particularly in 48, 47, 49. Adaniya has chosen to withhold so much and work with these silences from that withholding. And could you talk about some of the decisions that you had to make to do that? And and your creation of this commander.
I'm not sure it's very conscious and planned. It's a very strange process. It's almost, it has a lot of mystery mm-hmm. at its center. And deletions that it requires. I mean, from my side, I really would love to write a book 500 pages.
No, you don't.
But, but really, like, then I see the text looking at me and saying, no, you cannot do that. And I know it sounds a bit spooky, but I'm honest about it. I feel I experience language as a dynamic, as a being. And it's a being that is also evading. It's not an instrument. It's not an instrument that I'm using to tell something, but there's a lot of relation of mystery and perhaps even mistrust in this relation.
Mistrust of what?
Of articulation. I mean, I really, perhaps this is where I was born, in a context where those who tell stories clearly, convincing stories, in my case, in our case, are often those who are lying. And it doesn't need to be, by the way, only Israelis. I tell you, my sister did it. I remember, and this is, you know, this is also a very interesting moment. I have a sister, she's 4 years older. You know, 4 years older is a lot when you're a kid. So we fought. And she really attacked me, and I tried to defend myself. Now also I'm doubting myself. Anyway, so there's this story. And my mom notices us. We're fighting. Of course, we were not supposed to fight. We were supposed to be peaceful kids. She runs to my mother, and she tells the story so perfectly how I attacked her. And I was like, wow. And I was really fascinated. I think this is the moment I realized how somebody can create a whole story, and it's convincing, and my mother will believe her, and I'm watching her, and I'm really fascinated by the story. And then she looks at me and tells my mother, you see, she's even speechless. And this is a confirmation that she was right, and I got punished. And for me, I always go back to this moment. And of course, she later, she said, you know, like, this is how I got it. Like, you know, you don't have always to say the truth. Because you mumble. I mean, where do you start? And this mumbling, I mean, I experienced it in the case of when Palestinians start to tell. When you ask a Palestinian something, so what happened like 2 days ago? 2 days ago, but a month ago. No, 5 years ago. Well, 50 years ago. And then this whole time, because you don't know where to start, this constant stumbling on a beginning. And for me, it's very interesting to see why this stumbling, or also to think where does the story start? And this is a very interesting question, where any story starts. And really also as a kid, I was fascinated because, you know, my mom, she would have her friends, they would come, they say hello, hello, and at the end they say bye. But in the middle between this hello and bye, there's so many stories that suddenly evolve, and it's like, wow. And I wanted always to see this transition. I really, and I tried, because my mom wanted this time for her alone, without the kids, with her friends. And I remember me trying once to hide behind the curtain just to see this transition from a hello to stories. This beginning, the beginning. And this, they discovered me and they kicked me out. But this beginning, how and where a story starts. And in the, you know, in a case where your story is always eliminated, you don't choose the start, you stumble with language. And then you stumble with articulation. And then you think, but okay, if somebody want to take any beginning or decide a beginning and keep the rest in silence, why don't you become friends with silence? And not to treat it as an enemy. And I think this is an important realization for me. That, I mean, I go back to this story with my sister, and I know that I chose when she said the story and when my mom punished, I chose not to defend myself. And I think within that, this opened up a lot of many other possibilities, what it could have been. Why my sister did that, why I couldn't speak. So it brought so many questions. And in that sense, the silence became very inspiring. Mm-hmm. And it's really still until this moment. This sister, by the way, no, she doesn't write stories, just to, but she takes photographs. And it's very interesting that her interest is not on the thing that you can invent. She takes a lot of photography. I think perhaps that moment also haunts her. Yeah. how do you claim something to be truth? Mm-hmm. And those who are able often to choose a moment of a start, of an end, and to present the whole full story, and to make it perfect as if we are really can only believe in it is those who I don't trust. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My trust is in that which disappears, yeah, and allows dignity to that which is not spoken. And I think this is very important, that the dignity that language also can create within withholding. Mm-hmm.
You've described some of the you've described the way that you work with silence in your writing, similar to music and the silences in music. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, the way that music, how is silence there, and how do you envision that working similar in your writing? This was a long and old interview.
This is,
but I found it such an interesting.
This is a very hard question, which brings. Whenever I go to a concert, I just wait for the silence in it, and for it to finish. Yeah. I know it's terrible. Terrible. Like the best musical piece I ever heard is John Cage 366, The Silent. I appreciate that. But why? I mean, really, I also was thinking this about this yesterday, because Maza, she had an event at the Barenboim Said Academy, and they always start their events with a small concert. And of course, I was waiting for it to finish. And this waiting, I was wondering, what is that in silence? You know, the silence in the break of the between the musics. And in that, and I really also understood why John Cage also created that piece. It's within that silence, there's all these other sounds that they are not allowed to exist suddenly emerge. Mm. There's no moment of total silence. And this allows also the piece to constantly shift. If it's played here, if we take this moment of silence, the sounds we hear are going to be different if this piece played somewhere else. And it's amazing in how silence allows a place for so many things. Language sometimes, or naming, holds things up and limit them. And perhaps maybe for me, my difficulty with music, though it leaves language and it departs from articulation and clarity, but still it perhaps maintains some narrative within itself. And I have difficulty with narratives. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the first chapter is also trying to ask who always resort to narrative. Yeah. That's a struggle when always your narrative is broken, mm-hmm, is attacked, mm-hmm, is dismissed, is considered irrational or not very precise, not very credible, and so on. And for me, exactly, when your story is not credible, it's exactly, yes, this is fiction, this is literature. and how to hold on to that. And it's very, very interesting, you know, to how we all also share our love for literature and fiction, because it's almost allows all these other possibilities that they don't exist, but we know they can exist.
Yeah.
And this is with silence, perhaps. Yeah.
Makes me think about the way that we seek literature about things that have preoccupied us in our lives, or things that we are confused about, because in that putting into language our confusion, there is a narrative that's very clean and almost antiseptic that gets created. And all of these silences and questions can be removed if you create a coherent narrative.
Yeah.
It also reminds me, for some reason, when you were talking, I started thinking about the way that lawyers will tell you that the most credible witness is a witness who stumbles over things and has to go back and forth because they don't have a set narrative. They haven't worked out the story, you know, so quickly. I want to read just the opening sentence of Minor Detail, and this is from the perspective of, again, the commander, the Israeli commander. And it goes on to talk about the landscape and the sky and shadows in here. But the first sentence is, "Nothing moved except the mirage." And it's an incredibly powerful sentence that, again, withholds so much. Who's doing the looking when you first open this book? Where is this person? Mirage, is it real? Is it not? What exactly is happening? All of that withholding that and the silences that Adania is talking about is there. How did this first sentence come to be? What was the process of writing this? And eventually it moves into a description of the desert.
It came at the end. Completely. I think when I finished the novel, and this is strange also with writing, as it has its own order and own sentences inviting each other. But that was the last sentence I wrote in the book. Yeah. As if perhaps it's also, despite the clarity, it wanted to accentuate the lack of clarity,
mm-hmm.
perhaps. That yes, the only actually book that I struggled with the first sentence. I don't remember what was the first sentence initially. I struggled with the title and the... this first sentence, but the title came, and the last thing was this first sentence. Yeah,
and the novel it moves into a second part. The first part is with the commander, who is in the desert. I don't want to give too much away, but there is an act of brutality or several that take place, and then I think 25 years later, a young woman in Ramallah discovers this very minor detail, reading a newspaper account of the killing of a Bedouin girl by this commander.
She discovers it many decades later, but she gets attached to the date
of the birthday,
because it was committed 25 years before she was born.
Yes.
Yeah.
So she finds that out.
Yeah.
And it begins for her another journey. Could you talk a little bit about that? And just the structure of the book. This, here we have this commander, and then here we have this young woman in search of the history of another young woman. Did you know that this was what you wanted to write when you were thinking about it?
No, it's never. As I say, it's a process full of mystery and lack of clarity, at least for me. Like, it continues to be mysterious until the end. And this is the example. Like, I only know the beginning after I whole completed this. And this is a work of 12 years. So it's constantly going back and forth. I think it was already haunted before. With questions on this, if we take Palestine and we consider a literary form or a type of literature that is formed by these experiences, if we go back to what I mentioned earlier about the poetry that starts from a site of destruction and it comes in a certain way, so what type of literature would come out of Palestine? Palestine not as a nation or as a landscape, but as an experience. If we take Palestine as a literary teacher, as a professor of creative writing. So, you know, Palestine, what are you going to teach me now? Like new forms of, and we take Palestine to be very sensitive to its own experiences, to her own experiences. And this is for me the question is like how you come into not borrowing the language of others and not borrowing the structure, the literary structure enforced by others or enforced by the literature, which I really enjoy. I mean, I read these classical and I love them. But how can you also leave duplicating structures which you know they cause you pain? Yeah. Because it is this exact narrative of a land without people, that it's empty, a desert. There's nothing. So you're completely eliminated. Your presence, your grandparents, your great grandparents, your poets. Everybody's gone, because it's a land without anything. So how does this come? This kind of narrative. Do you want to go into a similar type of narrative to say, no, actually, there were people and so on, and kind of also repeating the same thing, but and mirroring it, yeah. And start to when my great grandfathers were here, and there are many stories, but these for me are stories of intimacy, and it's not about sharing them because it's not about me, it is about the language and the literature that comes from this and works in this level of mystery that also allows many of us to discover life. This is how we go to literature. I find literature always allows us to discover life or enter it in a way that perhaps we failed to see before with each book that touches us. Really, it's a kind of a new entry to the world, to those around us. And you think, okay, if I don't want to replicate these narrative structures, these type of stories, so what kind of stories can come? And I think this question always haunted me from the first book, also in the first novel. It's like, okay, it's about brokenness. It's about things which are not clear. It's about a narrative that is never listened to and never really heard. So it's a fragment of a narrative. Mm-hmm. There's this one side. And the inability to tell a story, to constantly diverge to unimportant issues where you see, okay, there is the main issue. Why don't you speak about that? But it's a main issue for whom?
Yeah.
And I think we can go back to another example, like I mentioned when we met in Berlin. So for you, for whom this is the important? It's for the gaze from outside, or is it the gaze from within? The gaze from within, or the literature from within, requires different type of structure. And I was trying to listen to that structure. And it's what that which led me to writing in this way. I should also describe that in a certain moment. I mean, I always do some... I indulge in very kind of... non-traditional researches just to run away from university. So I pretended, because, you know, as a student, you can pretend you're always a researcher, you're researching something. And I was very interested in courts and people getting divorced. I was very interested. I was like, you know. Yeah. And I was very interested, like, exactly as I tell you, like, how a story starts from hello to bye. I was interested how love ends. Mm. So I went to the court in Jerusalem and I said, I'm doing a research about some linguistic thing I invented, like, yeah, critical discourse analysis. I put it to them and they said, yeah, they don't know anything. And I said, yeah, I would like to investigate the speech bits in the court. And they gave me a permit. So I was sitting in these courts for months, just listening to people who are getting to get divorced, like, you know, the couple. And these are dramatic in Palestine, these court cases. And it was very interesting how there's the judge, there are the lawyers, and there are the people who are no longer in love with each other. And it was interesting to see how the language of law, the language of clarity, wanted to frame love and its end, and those miserable lovers and their inability actually to look at each other or to build a story together, because they were together, it is their story, but suddenly this story gets fragmented in a different way. And it was very interesting to see how you're going to describe this, yeah, this story. So I was like faced by this also, again, these two narratives, and in a very intimate level of the clarity of the law that wants to summarize the story. You married then and you had two kids and you would like to divorce because of this and that. So the summary was like a paragraph often. And these miserable lovers, they would go on for again and again and again to repeat, to convince the law of their own story. So there are also these kind of broken narratives, yeah, in between, but these are the intimate narratives. And so this also carried on with me, and then working with the press, I was a fixer, imagine me fixing stuff. Anyway, so, and translator, so we would go to, there was a famous case when Palestinian women were accused of sending their kids to be killed. Yeah, it was 2000. The press is very smart, as you always know. So the press wanted to investigate that. Do Palestinian women send their kids to die? You know, the press is very... And it was very, it's also very kind of a strong moment. So working for the press, we were in these press conferences where professional spokes, Israeli spokespersons were telling that story. And if you are there, you almost get convinced. It's like whole kind of built a story that, yeah, Palestinians use their kids as a human shield, which is also a repetition we hear constantly. It's never stops. And there was, so this is these men who speak very good English. They tell their stories perfectly. I mean, they don't hesitate. They don't stumble. They are not disfluent. And I was fascinated by, like, I look at them, like my sister, and how it's all clear and structured, and the argument is presented there that prompts journalists to go really to check that. You need to check that because it's convincing. And then you come, so how are you going to, as a journalist, investigate it? You have to go to the Palestinian mother, okay? And there comes my role as the translator, because the Palestinian mother doesn't speak English. Mm-hmm. And so this is like the whole process, you see, where it's so a journalist asks a mother, so do you send your kids to throw stones? And then the mother like, what? And there's like, I remember the eyes. I remember her eyes opening. This is the moment exactly of the silence. Like, where do you start the narrative? Mm-hmm. So she would like to say that, yes, of course we give everything for our freedom, you know? We give our lives, we give our children, we give our homes, everything for the cause of freedom. And they say, so you send your kids to... and so this is like, you know, it's a very strange moment of inversion of narrative. So what comes as an act of generosity, and the most that you would offer everything, it's like almost of love. You will offer everything towards this love. I will offer you everything I have, and everything, the most precious that I have is my kid, and I give you. So, you know, suddenly maybe... this speech that functions in two different levels, and you make them meet, they suddenly, either one is over the other, or they don't meet, or they clash, or they create this kind of almost a shattering in our emotional being. Mm-hmm. For me, what I learned from that, the mistake, perhaps, exactly going back, that how you engage with this kind of conversation. How the character, so if the narrative is about somebody who's committing a crime, are you going to follow him, or are you going to follow a different route? And I think this is the second chapter. But it's all, I mean, now I pretend like wise, but I'm not. So it all comes after, you know, it's in retrospect. But I remember all these processes and language in narration and telling stories that perhaps they also brought me to this moment of two narratives. Two narratives, they are not facing each other, but they're almost coming as echoes, but from different points. Yeah. As if a scenario to imagine, the Israeli spokesperson, the press officer, making this narrative. Yeah. And you follow into that, mm-hmm. and you understand where it comes from. And I don't want to make it like something that it's the... I think we all do it. It's not only the Israeli press officer. I think it is something that we ourselves are trapped in any situation of power, in our ability again to cause pain to others without stopping at that, because we think we don't even notice it. We don't notice this causing of pain, and that gaze of the mother who the journalist asked her, I still remember it. It's almost like this, you know, the openness of her eyes, the lack of understanding, and it's this lack of understanding. Like, what kind of narrative, what kind of literature can come out of this lack of understanding? Mm-hmm. And this is for me the second, you know, she doesn't understand.
Yeah.
She doesn't even understand why she's doing this research, where it's going, where will it lead. It's not about clarity. So it's the opposite of this clarity. Yeah. Yeah.
She feels compelled to make this journey, to try to go to the place where this girl decades earlier, whose death was on the same day as her birthday, you know, she's trying to find out what happened. She's trying to go to the place. And I remember you wrote recently in an article, in a beautiful essay for Berlin Review, you talked about the fact that this incident that this woman in the book is trying to investigate without really knowing what compels her to do it, that incident... did occur. It was true. It did happen. It had been printed in, I believe, Haaretz or another newspaper in Israel, that the soldiers that had been involved or had witnessed this girl's rape and killing had talked about it. But you said something really interesting in that essay that it doesn't matter. It's not the point. The important thing is not that this actually happened. And I wondered if you could talk about, there's something here that that I understood in reading that between reporting what's true, quote unquote, and writing something towards a different kind of truth. And maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but could you talk about that?
I mean, let's replace truth with fiction.
Yeah.
For me, it's really, I'm interested in fiction. Even I see truth, a host of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in fiction and fiction that perhaps sometimes, like as how literature allows us to discover things that truth is incapable of allowing us. I think fiction does that. And you know, the narrative of truth has been so much structured in a certain way that it only could be this possibility. And this is a possibility of designing what truth has been set by the powerful. It's not the criteria for truth have not been set by the powerless or the victims, because for them, the inability to articulate, the refusal to articulate are inherent, they are part of the pain. And this is, I came to realize, I told you my parents were silent for a long time, and I hated that, you know. Because for me, the silence was heavy. But now I understood why. I mean, they were 18 when the Nakba took place. Sorry, 15, sorry. They married when they were 15. No, 18. They were 15. And it's... I mean, now we understand how we cannot speak.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the first time I understand how it's not possible to speak. I mean, I'm in touch with Palestinian, and we can't speak.
Yeah. I'm reminded of just hearing you say that of my own family's inability to speak about so much of what they saw or what our family went through in the revolution. And whenever I would ask my mother to tell me stories about certain family members of ours that were disappeared, the only thing she could do, speaking of language, is stand up and sing a song. And that was it. That was all the information I got. And still to this day, you know, it takes a while to understand that.
That's very interesting, because I actually also remember once my mom doing that.
Hmm.
And my mom had a terrible voice.
My mom
said, so it's like, please stop it.
Yeah,
as if language, how we expect it to inform. It's not about informing, it's about being.
Yeah.
And I think this is also how important to go into that level of allowing this, because it is about being. Language is about being in that case. Mm-hmm. And going to second part, it is about also tracing, if we go, you mentioned the investigation, the language of investigation. So we investigate normally, if there's a crime, you follow on the footsteps of the criminal to discover the details of the crime, because the criminal has all the information. It's available. But you cannot follow the crime from the perspective of the victim, because the victim already perished,
yeah.
You know? Well, you don't have access to that. But okay, let's imagine that you will follow in the footsteps of the victim. What will happen to you? What kind of narrative will appear? Mm-hmm. What kind of destiny will await you? Yeah. Will it be a destiny, hey, I come and share with you something, or is it completely different? And this is, I think, this is the moment of divergence.
Yeah.
And how literature also can diverge in different directions, which are not the ones about, you know, the grand narrative.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think in Palestine or Palestine as literature, there is a grand narrative
mm-hmm.
ever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if anybody claims there's a grand narrative, it's a fiction. It's a good exercise in
yeah.
fiction
yeah.
because it's a narrative that is filled with absences,
yeah.
and you cannot overcome these absences.
Yeah.
Because when you try to overcome, you only can overcome them through the narrative of the powerful, of those who have the language and the ability
yeah.
and the strength to articulate. I mean, in which language? Again, when we are in pain, the last thing we are able is to describe what we are feeling. We don't want language when we are in pain. And this is a struggle. And I think if you maintain that place of perhaps pain and language, they can exist together within silence.
Yeah.
You know, it allows it.
I'm reminded... I know we're almost running out of time, but please bear with us.
Mm-hmm.
I was having this conversation yesterday in Berlin about partly your book, but there was a series of photographs that came out from India. And two separate photographers, one a Western photographer and another an Indian photographer, quite separately from each other, decided that they were going to create a photo essay on some of the very, very poor areas in India and a particular section of, I think it was New Delhi, where sex workers lived and worked. And so you have this Western writer, and I was looking at his images initially, who was placing himself in the room where the woman was working with a client. And there was always this desire to get the full room, to have the camera, you know, from an overhead perspective or standing at the door. It makes me think of this grand narrative that you're talking about. To get it all, to tell this full scope of what's in the room, who is in there, what's happening. Quite separately, I just stumbled soon after that on a book by an Indian photographer, same section, same areas. Same idea of a photo essay. What he did was get in the bed of where the sex workers worked and just take photographs of the ceiling. And there's a difference there in what you're saying is a grand narrative and this willingness to enter within, to enter into the story. And no matter the omissions, there is something else there that's being created that is intimate and real. And I feel that Minor Detail is written from that perspective. These omissions and silences tell their own stories. It works in unison, in harmony, if we speak of music, with that ceiling that's photographed. I want to ask it's not going to be quick, but we'll do it anyway, because we're now on photographs, and Adania is just a brilliant thinker and writer, and but I have recently discovered that she did a PhD in London on media and cultural studies, if I'm correct. And your PhD was on visual terror on 9/11, in 9/11. And I wondered if
On
the war on terror. Yeah. And I wondered if you could talk about that, because when I think of 9/11, of course, I think of the Abu Ghraib photographs. I think of the photograph of the burning towers. The photograph of the man that's falling, but the photograph of the complete degradation of Iraqis and Afghanis. I'm interested in what your thinking was, what you realized or what you were thinking about as you were writing this, and what are you thinking now with, you know, the visual terror, visual war on terror today?
Yeah, this is not going to be a short.
It's not going to be short.
Okay. Well, I never have had a TV. I never have a TV, but I had a radio. So when the 9/11 attacks happened, I learned about it from the radio. I always listened to the radio. I never watched. And everybody was talking about the images. I didn't watch the images. And this constant conversation about the images. And the images, and the images. And you start, yeah, of course, eventually the obsession is with the image of what we see. So it is about us, mm-hmm. more than the pain of others. Anyway, I have this habit, maybe it's okay, I study media, but I like to read newspapers after a few months from when they are published. And try to do it. It's very interesting because you will read the news in a different way. It becomes not literature, but it becomes it allows something else to take a place in our mind and our reading when the news are no longer news. So I was actually in London when I did this PhD because I was interested with this idea of the image. Mm. The constant obsession with the image. Why it's the image that strike us, and why it's only we constant. I mean, even Bush was referring to the images. Everybody was referring to the images. So the images, they become the main thing. A lot of attention to them. So it became also a game with myself that I don't want to see the images. I waited 4 years. Before see it. So I went to the archives of the BBC, and I asked them to give me all the videos they had for the 9/11 attacks and the war on terror, basically also the war in Afghanistan and on Iraq. They were like, I don't know. I remember because I paid for the hours. you need to pay for the videos. I became also a friend with the guy down there. So there were 70 hours that I was watching. And I just go to this archive for months and so on, and I put the video in the morning. It's like a job, you know, to watch and rewind. And exactly this moment also of rewinding, which also plays as something. because, you know, when you're researching, you always have to rewind. And there was a moment I was rewinding, and the towers also went back, and they stood. And the plane was out. Yeah. And that was because I have to confess that the first moment I saw them, I was also got very emotional watching the videos for years after, yeah. Imagine, you know. And then when I returned them, I discovered this trick on me that I was watching the image. My emotion that was triggered by the image. And when I rewinded and I saw how it was going back, the plane, everything, the 9/11, the Twin Towers, they stood, no fire, nothing. You realize this fact, what images are, how much they are their own being. I mean, of course, they can exist on their own. This is not about a reference to a reality, but they create their own tools, yeah. of being. And at that moment also, because also in with terror, they, when I was trying to search for the definition of terror and the history of the term, how it appeared, I like to do these kind of sometimes Don Quixote's kind of research. So I go to all the books the first time the term is mentioned and the French Revolution, and you go with it, and how it was reintroduced in the 70s, the Americans, the Israelis, and so on. But what was tricky with the word terror, that there's no single definition of the term. So it's and this is normal, because language always changes. We can change the definitions. But there's one researcher says, true, there's or one thinker, there's no definition, one definition. There's not agreed, one single agreed of the definition doesn't exist in the whole, you know, no law, no UN, nothing. I mean, they're all, everybody comes with something new. But they say, if you see it, you know it. So I was interested. Okay, so what do we see when we see terror? And in fact, what we see when we see terror, we don't see anything. And this is terror. And this is the fact of like how you know, the idea of the invisibility of the terrorists and this fear from what we don't see. And also our lack of interest in what we don't see. So it is a very interesting relation between what we fear and what it doesn't interest us. That comes in a different way. And you see how it functions and how it's constructed. You become imprisoned in this invisibility, in a sea of visibility, and vice versa. Now also I don't look at images.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'm capable.
I've wondered for a long time about what it means to witness, speaking of images. And it, you know, in the last 5 months now, almost 6 months, we've been asked as a collective to witness what is happening in Gaza and the West Bank, to understand what has been happening in Palestine. Adania, there are those of us, I've spoken with friends who feel that we need to look at some of these images so that we can begin to describe them or reckon with them for those who are not capable or don't want to do that. But I'm wondering if, as we close this out, if you can talk to us about what it means to witness today and maybe the place of language today. You and I have had conversations about what language means and what justice means now, but maybe you could share.
I don't want to be a witness, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that is a good ending. Thank you.
Du har hørt på Litteraturhusets podcast, som presenterer bearbeidede versjoner av samtaler og foredrag fra Litteraturhusets program. Del gjerne podcasten med familie og venner via iTunes eller SoundCloud om du liker det du har hørt. Følg oss også på Facebook og på litteraturhuset.no for informasjon om flere aktuelle arrangementer. Musikken er laget av Apotek.